Webster's Dictionary defines compliance as the action or fact of complying with a wish or command. This is the Compliance Guy.
The Compliance Guy.
As a healthcare provider or healthcare professional, navigating the muddy waters of compliance can get tricky.
And that's why we're here.
Helping you mitigate risk while increasing your profitability. This is the Compliance Guy. Now, here's your host, Sean Weiss.
All right. Hey, everybody. Happy Tuesday. We are now in the month of April 2024. It is the ninth day of the month, believe it or not. Time is just flying. And with it being a Tuesday, that means it is a hashtag Terry Tuesday. So I get to spend some time with my very good friend in California, Terry Fletcher. How are you?
I'm good. We're warming up this week to 80 degree temps, so I'm good.
Yeah, we saw mid-70s here over the weekend, which was nice. I was out in Honolulu last week. I got an opportunity to speak a couple of different times at the American Medical Billing Association conference. What a great group. It was unbelievable to see how many people traveled from all over the country.
Now, Sean, that's a 5.5 hour flight from Los Angeles for me. How far is that for you?
9 hours and 50 minutes nonstop.
Oh, shoot.
Yeah.
And you never seem to stay to linger and enjoy the time. You usually fly in and out. Is that what you did?
Yeah. So, Jill, my wife, actually found out that I was going to Hawaii, and she was like, "Oh no, my friend, I am going with you." And, so we flew out on a Sunday, and so we left Sunday morning from Atlanta at like 9 o'clock, and we got to Honolulu, which is a 6 hour time difference, at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And then we left on Thursday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon to come home, and we got home Friday morning at 6 a.m.
I was going to say, yeah, the trip home had to be brutal, so.
Yeah, and, you know, it was in their premium select cabin, and I will tell you, they were probably the most uncomfortable seats I've ever been in on Delta Airlines.
Yeah, I'm a spoiled brat. I only fly first now, which tells you how often I don't fly. I will not fly in anything but first class.
Yeah, well, we flew in Delta One, right, on the way out there, which, you know, it's that lie
business
flat
class,
bed.
Yeah,
it's the lie flat. It's like the international first.
Right, it's nice.
The problem is I have such broad shoulders that I can't recline all the way back in that seat unless I am turned to my side, because my shoulders just don't fit. So I, for 9 hours and 50 minutes, either had to lay on my left side or my right side, or I had to sit my seat up to where my shoulders were above the lie flat portion. So not really comfortable. On the flight home, it's what they call Delta Select, which is their business class, their first class. And I will tell you, it was even more uncomfortable than Delta One, because the seats don't fully recline. So they recline, I don't know, maybe 30 degrees, something like that, 35 degrees. And then they have these footrests that extend from the bottom. Well, the problem is I'm 6 foot tall, and the footrest is meant for somebody who's 5'8". So my feet were literally hanging off of the footrest, and it was just not a comfortable flight. And then, of course, you know, my wife decides she wants to use my shoulder.
Sitting there for her, you know.
So, yeah. So, you know, I have her on my shoulder. I have my feet hanging off. The food, I know people are listening to this and like, "Oh, poor baby." No, but seriously, when you pay this kind of money, right? You know, because the conference pays for you to fly.
They give us a minimum stipend, right? Usually they don't pay for first class.
Right. So I had to pay all the extra money, right? Which I don't mind doing. I mean, because I want to be comfortable, especially on a 10 hour flight.
Yeah.
But when I tell you, I wouldn't serve the food that they served us to my dogs.
Yeah.
It was vile. I don't know. Like, it, seriously, it's like hospital food. Like, if they forced the chefs at Delta to eat their own crap, they wouldn't serve it to anybody else.
I fly American, but you're in Atlanta, so you have to fly Delta.
Yeah, I fly Delta.
I fly right now. If I'm flying, I fly anybody who doesn't use Boeing. Sorry, I'm putting that out there. With all the reports and all this stuff going on, I'm like, no, give me an Airbus any day. I'm not doing that.
Yeah, this was a nice jet. It was a A330 Airbus. It was pretty nice. But anyways, you know, listen, Honolulu was nice. It drizzled every single day that we were there. We got scant. No, the weather was beautiful. We drove to the North Shore a couple of times. We did get scammed, and I'm ashamed to admit it, because I've been to Hawaii for, 18 years. I had been going to Hawaii, speaking out there and doing work with medical groups and stuff like that. I got scammed. They had a whale watching tour, and I know that the whale watching season is typically November until like March, April, something like that. And I forgot that the whales in late March start migrating away from Honolulu and they start moving towards Maui. And, my wife was like, hey, I really want to go on this whale watching thing. And I was like, yeah, I don't know. It may not be the right time. And then we called and the guy's like, oh yeah, the whale watching's fantastic. Come on, blah, blah, blah. So it's like $150 or something like that for us to go on this whale watching thing. So us and like 73 other morons got stuck into this whale watching cruise, and there was not one whale. And what was funny was when I got onto the boat, like one of the deckhands, I said to him, hey, how's the whale watching been? He goes, not good. And I said, really? He goes, yeah, this is not a great time of year to do whale watching. And you're like,
well, do we still have to go?
Yeah. And I said, well, when's the last time you saw a whale? He goes, let's just say it's been a while.
Oh, no.
So I went up and told Jill, and she was like, how did you let us get scammed? And I was like, oh, God, here we go. It's always my fault. But anyways, I've now wasted enough of everybody's time. Let's jump in. Let's talk about prior authorizations, because I think folks really need to understand what is going on in the world of prior auths.
They do. So let me kind of start a little bit here about prior authorizations and really what they are, the basics. So we've got a couple of different options. We've got electronic prior authorizations, and then we've got just regular prior authorizations, I guess you'd call them, where there's a lot of manual work put into getting authorization for services that basically it's putting something, it's basically alerting a payer that this is something that you want to do, and can we do it? Does the policy provisions, policy contracted information, does the coverage allow for the patient to have this service? And not everything needs a prior authorization. And just for short, you're going to hear the acronym PAs, even though that's not the physician assistant, it's prior authorization, or EPA, which is the electronic prior authorization. But what I've found, because I was mentioning offline that I'm going through an accreditation program for an actual credential in prior authorization work and facilitation, I found that what's interesting is how many people are still involved in the manual process. How a lot of practices haven't embraced the electronic process, which sometimes that can be an automatic approval or denial, but then you know what you need to do. Or how many offices or practices, and I think this is probably what we really need to chat about, they don't have dedicated staff to this. So we have coders, we have billers, we have collectors, and I'm finding that and not to discount what front office people do. I mean, you are in charge of the first, look from the patients. I think you have a very tough job if you're a front office person. But, a coder, a biller, you have to have skills that understand contracts, that understand the process, that have how to navigate through a payer's website and find their policies if they've got certain forms you need. And I'm finding that a lot of practices have not considered this kind of staff member in their workflows. they haven't realized that a prior authorization professional is needed. They said, okay, so who wants to do this? Or there's not one person. You end up having them all over the office. One person wants to fax it. Another person wants to call it in. Another person wants to use the EPA. And I'm just like, wow, some people do it through mail. Oh my gosh, on snail mail. And then some people do forget to certify it. Or they say, well, there's only a PO box. And I'm like, well, that's not true. or they say that I'll do it through email. They don't encrypt it. So, you know, I'm going to throw it back to you because I know you've dealt with this a lot too, but this is coming up a lot in some of the legal work that's happening too, because I think people think a prior authorization means guarantee of payment when that's not what it is either. Well, sometimes on prescription drugs it is, but when it comes to services in general, it's more of an alert as far as letting the insurance company know this is the plan. And, you know, we know that we have coverage for it, and then they give you typically a number. But, you know, I'm having a hard time with different things about the process, because I know there's some states that do it different and there's no streamlining. There's no streamlining. And just the last thing, then I'll send it over to you, is that there was something called in July of 2022 introduced to Congress, and it's called the Seniors Timely Access to Care. It's HR 3173. And everyone, you can Google it, look it up. And people were like, oh, this is one step closer to becoming a law. Well, it was introduced in 2021 and it got voted on the House in the fall of 2022. Look how long that took. It passed in the House and it's still sitting there for the Senate. And we're in 2024 now. It's like they're like, oh, well, we'll get to it. And I know there's been, you know, little, you know, victories, they say, where something is going to be applied for Medicare Advantage plans come 2026. But in the meantime, people are drowning because they can't get the care they want because the process is like a racket. To me, this is such a win-win, the process of it, for payers, not for providers. And there's an average right now. I know the ACMA says that providers are spending almost 14 hours a week on average just on prior authorizations. You need to have a staff member.
I believe that. I believe that. Listen.
A lot of unpack there, I know.
Yeah. No, here's the deal, right? So first thing, right? A prior authorization is not a guarantee of reimbursement. How do we know that? Because the insurance companies actually tell us that in their prior authorization approval. It says this prior authorization is not a guarantee of payment. I mean, can't be much more clear about that, right? A prior authorization, to your point, Terry, basically says this is a service that is potentially covered under the members' benefits for the plan that they have selected. And depending on the diagnoses, depending on the medical necessity, the appropriateness, the reasonableness, depending upon our medical coverage policies, once we receive the claim, we will give it further consideration as to whether or not we should be actually paying for this service, or if it is the member's responsibility, or if it's something after we review it, because something has changed, whether or not it is any longer a covered service, right? Think about how many times we do a prior authorization and then the surgeon or the physician performs whatever the service is supposed to be, but there's a modification to it. It's not quite what they got pre-authorized. So they submit a claim and the CPT codes are different, you know, or there's more CPT codes or whatever it may be. The diagnosis has changed, whatever it is. So now it creates problems. The losers in prior authorization are two people: the provider and the beneficiary. The insurance company is usually the one who wins. So, Terry, talk a little bit more about this this bill that's in Congress right now for just a moment.
Yeah. So what it is it's basically trying to ease the burden, they call it, of and modify and try to streamline the, they call it interoperability of prior authorization. So I know a lot of people say, oh, we shouldn't have them at all. Well, that's not true, because you need to make sure that medications are appropriate for this diagnosis. And sometimes the medical records don't support, you and I know that, at all the legal work we've done and all the auditing we've done, don't support what the next step is. And so it also kind of is an oversight way to, you know, keep people in check, keep the providers in check. So I think that's part is a good thing. But the problem is that it's kind of given, you know, the payers kind of a free pass to create a barrier for patients to receive timely care. And it's put an unnecessary burden on providers to try to find, you know, staff members that are responsible for other jobs to figure out how to get, you know, certain medications or medical services authorized for payment and for the patient, because it's not just authorized payment for the provider. It's making sure that it's not denied so that that isn't transferred to the patient. And I think one of the things that is really important, and I'm learning this as I went through this process for this credential as well, is that, and I knew this going back, just being involved in all the prior authorizations and coding and billing and everything. Don't always think that if a prior authorization, if it's denied for whatever care you want, that doesn't mean, okay, it's over. It means that you still have an opportunity to find possible exceptions to, you know, state your case. I had one practice, we were doing a workflow audit on their revenue cycle management, and they did have two prior authorization people in there, 450 physicians. I was like, oh my gosh. They had 20 coders and only two PAs. And I just said, okay. And they said, yeah, we have a problem because we don't have access to the physicians. We can't query them. We can't ask them questions. We can only go to the administrator. And that's a problem. They should be able to query a physician if they have a question on an order. And the other thing is they said, yeah, if it gets denied, we just tell the patient they can't have it. I'm like, oh my gosh, just one little thing. It was a wheelchair that it was medically necessary, patient needed it. And it was denied incorrectly by the payer. And they basically told the patient you can't have one. So I just went in and I said, well, let me show you how to fix this. And this is what the information, patient had broken their hip. They were on this kind of path. They also had scoliosis and there was a medically necessary reason for them to have a wheelchair. And just giving them additional information, calling the payer and just talking to somebody in that department. And they said, oh, okay, we'll approve it. And let me send it to you right now. And it was approved within like 20 minutes. And she's like, I didn't even know we could call and follow up. So when I talk about staff members being responsible, prior authorization is to me on the level of importance as coding, billing, revenue cycle management, back office staff. I mean, it's on an even level. And with the struggles that I think go with it, you have to have people, and I say this with love, but you have to have competent people that not only understand the process, but understand when you get into, you know, when there's a hiccup or when there is a mountain to climb and you've trying to push something through for a patient that you know they have coverage for. And it really bothers me when it's kind of like, Sean, you probably deal with this. How many times have you audited a practice? And when an EOB comes in and they say, well, because the payer denied it, we just write it off. And you're like, yeah, oh my gosh.
I hear this all the time, more and more every single day.
Me too. And they say, well, we're never going to get paid. Well, it's same. I hear this on prior authorizations. Well, it'll never go through. Never is a long time. you have to work the system and make sure that if the patient has coverage, if there's an opportunity to reflect medical necessity, you can't quit and not really try to push it through. These are patients. They count on us to make this happen. And the system is terrible right now. So until it's fixed, it's really up to the prior authorization professional to get it done. And I'm hoping anyone who listens to this podcast realizes that you need dedicated
staff. Oh yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, listen, obviously, you know, there's significant cost to hiring staff, right? And especially, you know, when you're trying to justify, you know, paying somebody whatever you're paying them to do prior authorization. But keep in mind, prior authorization is one of the most significant parts of the revenue cycle. So why would we not want to have highly skilled, highly trained, highly adaptable types of individuals in those roles to make sure that they understand the nuance of each of the different insurance companies that you have to get a prior authorization for? Now, remember,
have you ever used the prior authorization in your legal work?
From what standpoint?
For something that they, you know, that they're trying to say that's not covered and somebody has a prior authorization, mostly medicines is easier. Yes.
So, okay. So we have had cases and I'm trying to think of the case that, one of the more recent ones. Anyways, it will come to me. We actually were able to demonstrate for the jury that it's impossible to accuse a provider of committing fraud when the provider is notifying an insurance company in advance that these are the services that we plan to provide for your member. Right. And
yeah, I told you,
here's the CPT codes. Here's the medical rationale. Here are the diagnosis codes. Here are the progress notes showing everything that was done from a conservative point of view prior to taking the patient to a more invasive procedure. And here's the insurance company saying, you are pre-approved to perform the following services on our member. However, keep in mind, this is not a guarantee of payment. Well, you can't accuse somebody of committing fraud where you're saying they have created a scheme or an artifice when they have basically said to you, hey guys, here's what we're going to do for your member, our patient. Kind of defeats the purpose of somebody looking to commit fraud to tell somebody in advance, here's what I'm going to do.
Right. I had the same thing with vein ablations. I had a vascular practice that the DOJ came in and was taking a look at them and just saying, oh, they were doing things too excessive and all this. And I said, you know, this actually has a PA process after you've had the first ablation. Okay. They don't need it for the first one, as long as the medical necessity is there. But for anything after the first one, within 6 months, you have to have a PA. And they had them all. They actually followed it to the letter, what the rules were. And the PAs sometimes would, most of the time would say yes, sometimes said no, and then they'd send information. And then they'd come back and say, you can have it. And then it would be denied. And, you know, I showed them all this and they were trying to use the, you know, thing about, well, it says that it's not necessarily a guarantee of payment. I said, no, but what you're trying to say is that the doctor is trying to do, you know, medically necessary services without authorization. No, we had authorization. We're not talking about payment here. We're talking about authorization. We had it. You know, they put in all the information. They had the medical necessity. You're just saying because there were so many denials, it triggered an audit. Well, denials on the payer side has almost nothing to do with authorization. I'm using your own rules. So it was just interesting because I think people miss that. Well, and I don't like it when I hear, well, they're not going to pay it anyway. Well, that doesn't mean you don't still go through the process because they might pay it. They may pay it. Let's hopefully they do pay it, but you can always really, you know, look at the system and find an exception. That's the one thing nice about, I guess, the good thing, I guess, about that there's not always a perfect standard on everything is that there is some flexibility here when it comes to prior authorizations. If you get a denial, you can always open it up again and said, okay, well, wait, did you read everything? Did you assess everything? Because you and I know prior authorizations goes to an automatic somebody at the insurance company. You know, or it goes to, you know, the pharmacy tech at the insurance company, the payer. It's not necessarily going to somebody who's looking at it. It's just following edits. Right. Second level of appeal, and we do have second level appeals on authorizations to people, is that you now are talking to somebody who's actually going to read what you send, is actually going to review the information. So I guess the reason I really wanted to bring this topic up today is just to encourage people who are involved in the prior authorization process that, you know, don't get frustrated. Make sure you follow everything that you need to do as far as what the payer rules are for that particular patient. But look and navigate their websites. Understand the process. Follow the payer guidelines because every payer is different. Every state is different. And I'm going to send you, Sean, with the last thing about what's going on in Texas. with the prior authorization gold.
Yeah. Card. So there is a program in the state of Texas, and I know the Tennessee Medical Association has been working on it, and it's called either the Gold Card or the Gold Star program. And basically what happens is after a provider has achieved a 90% success rate with prior authorizations for those services and or procedures, once they hit that 90%, they no longer are required to file for prior authorizations. Those accounts, meaning the provider, and for that selection of CPT codes,
so basically they've proven themselves that
They're no longer subject to the prior approval process. So take a look in your state where your practice is located and see what is being offered there, because you may find that there is a similar program either already in place or something that is in the process of being put into place that you can now engage in meaningful dialogue with the payers to get onto that list.
Okay. I think we kind of covered this topic today.
Yeah, I think we did. And I know that I had a couple of sticky moments on my audio today. I apologize. We're not sure what's going on here on my end, but hopefully Terry, who shares part of my brain with me, good job at finishing out my set. I'm going to stop now before it gets any worse and say thank you, Terry, as always, for joining me on this hashtag Terry Tuesday episode.
Thank you.
All right. And to each and every single one of y'all, thank you so much for tuning in, logging on, and hanging out with Terry and I for just a little while. I'll be back later this week with a Legal with Lyles Parker. Ashley Morgan and Robert Lyles will be joining me live. So I'm looking forward to that on Thursday this week. So until then, remember, be good to yourself, but more importantly, y'all be good to each other. Take care.
You've been listening to The Compliance Guy. Sean has been doing this for 28 years. He holds 10 national board certifications. He's a partner and the vice president of compliance for Doctors Management, LLC. He's a subject matter expert in federal court. He's lectured at the most prestigious institutions. He's engaged with members of Congress in both chambers. So what we're saying is he's qualified? We hope you've enjoyed the show. Make sure to like, rate, and review. And we'll be back soon. But in the meantime, you can find us on social media @The Compliance Guy. See you next time on The Compliance Guy.